Okay, well, I am so happy to be able to teach another Sunday school lesson. This is something that I really do enjoy. I'm not in the classroom anymore, and so I don't get a lot of opportunities to teach, but it's something that I really like to do, and I'm very appreciative to Pastor that he makes sure that he gives me the opportunities to do so. I also appreciate you all sitting through plenty of history lessons whenever I'm up here. Today, not so much. I suppose it's maybe falls under the category of philosophy a little bit, which always seems to go hand in hand with history because there's so many philosophers, major philosophers that are big figures in history as well. But the topic today is at least what I think is the hardest question to answer. And so before I go to the next slide and show you what I think that is, I'd like to hear from all of you what you think, and it could be, it should be of I suppose, a spiritual topic, but maybe it is a little bit more philosophical and not specifically, a question that comes up when you're reading the Bible. It could just be about life in general, but what do you think is the hardest question to answer? Mr. Pierce? Why would someone reject God's love and offer of salvation? It's a tough question. Janet?
What's the purpose of life and what's my role in it?
What's the purpose of life and the role that you have in it? It's good. We may need to get the mic. I know Pastor likes to have the questions recorded as well. That's a tough question. I think both of those fall under something that might inspire these most difficult questions is what kind of questions do people ask when you're trying to witness to them or when you're just trying to talk about God in general and his existence, right? Why would God send anyone to hell? And that's closer to the question that I have on the next slide. So this, go ahead.
Why does sin exist?
Why does sin exist? Now, see, you guys are, we're on the same wavelength now. I think that this is the hardest question to answer. Why do bad things happen? And there's a variant of this question that is very common, especially when you're talking to atheists, which is why do bad things happen to good people, right? And so you have this interesting dichotomy between good and bad and how an atheist defines that to begin with because they don't believe in God. So of course, there's a bunch of different pathways that an atheist could take in their philosophy on life. Usually, it leads to what's called nihilism, which is the belief that everything is meaningless and nothing matters. So you can imagine that if you're someone who espouses that kind of belief, you are probably not very happy because nothing you do matters. There's really no purpose to life, and your place in it is as unimportant as the next person's place in it. It's basically just how much pleasure, I suppose, you can get out of life, personal, and even that is meaningless, right? Because it's just passing, and then when you die, you're gone, and people forget you, and that's it. I'm the type of person that, when I see a question like this, I think as Christians, we can look at it and go, well, we know why bad things happen. It's because we go back to the creation story, the fall of Adam and man's sin nature and his need for a redeemer. And I think there are several people who, fortunately, and unlike me, can just kind of move on and say, well, that's why bad things happen, because man made the choice and now we have a sin nature and that's it. In my brain, that's not a satisfactory enough answer. I really want to get into it and understand from a sinner's point of view this question, because when we're trying to witness to somebody, what do we use? The Bible. But if it's an atheist, do they believe the Bible? No. Okay. And what Pastor always says, and he's correct, is when you're witnessing to somebody, you have to use the Bible and you have to quote the Bible, even if they don't believe the Bible, because that's what everything is based on. You still have to always bring them back to truth. Okay. But it's the pathway, I suppose, that I'm the most interested in, which is how do you get from a question like this and get them on the pathway that's back to the Bible and the Bible reference, right? Because just quoting the passage in Genesis where Adam makes the bad decision to someone who's atheist is very often not enough. People that are atheists in worldly knowledge are are sometimes extremely intelligent people, very high functioning. They are typically in the field of science, and so they know a lot of things about a lot of things that the layperson like myself does not know. And so they can really put you into a mental bind because of the way that they have with words, but also just the amount of knowledge that they have, just the amount of facts. And they could spout off a lot of philosophical and data-based research that can really cause Christians some questions. And so while for a child, salvation is very simple, good and bad are very simple, it's to get someone who is a very high-functioning atheist to get to the point where you're breaking down their thinking when it comes to God, when you're breaking that down so that they can have the mind of a child to accept Christ. Again, that's the pathway that I'm interested in. This kind of started because of the last lesson that I taught on Islam. This is where I was talking about Israel's controversial command from God. We can find that in Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 17. So let's go ahead and turn there. What I was doing was I was talking about the difference between Israel receiving a command from God to go into the land of Canaan and, in a lot of cases, annihilate the tribes that were there, and contrasting that with the idea of jihad, which is struggle, is the most accurate translation of that word. And many non-radicalized Muslims believe that jihad is more of a personal inward struggle of good versus bad, which of course is something that we would liken to our comparison of man's sin nature and how it struggles against our desire to, as Christians, our desire to do what's right. And Paul talks about this in length in the New Testament. So in Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 17, okay. We're going to reset. For my devotions, I usually use the ESV, and so that's what I'm on right now. There we go. Switch it to KJV. All right. Deuteronomy 20, 16 through 17 says, "But of the cities of these people, the people of the tribes of Canaan, which the Lord thy God doth give thee for an inheritance, thou shalt save alive nothing that breatheth. But thou shalt utterly destroy them, namely the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, and the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites, as the Lord thy God hath commanded thee." And there's actually several different passages where the Israelites carry out this command. Of course, there's a lot where they don't as well, and they fail to abide by the very specific instruction that God gives them when they enter the land. But the problem is that we view that as a bad thing. Okay, so when we're talking about why do bad things happen, we look at Israel going into the land of Canaan and annihilating these tribes and the livestock and so forth, and we have no way to really justify a lot of that in our minds very easily, because we're talking about annihilation is annihilation. Right? It's the destruction of men, women, children. I mean, it seems very difficult to wrap our head around that would be a command that God has given. And if that happens during a war, for example, today, what is the biggest accusations that, for example, Israel and the country that they're fighting, Hamas is the group. Gaza, thank you. Those that are in the Gaza Strip, they always accuse each other of doing what? killing women and children, right? Killing innocents, killing people that are not actually combatants. So even today, in our minds, we always think that that is one of the worst things that can happen in a war, right? So this is an argument from an atheist that I read when talking about this. And of course, what he is, this is Sam Harris, what he is talking about is, you know, the bad things that God allows to happen if you're a Christian and how you justify that. But in this case, it's even a command from God, right? So Sam Harris says in his book, An Atheist Manifesto, if God exists, either he can do nothing to stop the most egregious calamities or he does not care to. God, therefore, is either impotent or evil. Pious readers will now execute the following pirouette. God cannot be judged by merely human standards of morality, but of course human standards of morality are precisely what the faithful use to establish God's goodness in the first place. Now, that's a straw man argument. He's making an argument on our behalf that actually is not accurate, because we would say that those are not human standards of morality. Those are actually God's standards of morality. Those are a much higher standard than what he's talking about here. But he continues, and any God who could concern himself with something as trivial as gay marriage or the name by which he is addressed in prayer is not as inscrutable as all that. If he exists, the God of Abraham is not merely unworthy of the immensity of creation, he is unworthy even of man. And that is quite the statement. There's another possibility, of course, and it is both the most reasonable and least odious, at least according to him. The biblical God is a fiction. It is terrible that we all die and lose everything we love. It is doubly terrible that so many human beings suffer needlessly while alive. That so much of this suffering can be directly attributed to religion, to religious hatreds, religious wars, religious delusions, and religious diversions of scarce resources, is what makes atheism a moral and intellectual necessity. It is a necessity, however, that places the atheist at the margins of society. The atheist, by merely being in touch with reality, appears shamefully out of touch with the fantasy life of his neighbors. So, there's a lot to break down in that statement, and there's a lot of people that debate Sam Harris. He's a very vocal atheist. In fact, he's had some appearances on some talk shows, some news talk shows, where he very bluntly attacks Islam and actually takes a stance that many conservatives would agree with, which is Islam is a dangerous religion and one that you should not allow to pervade society because of its corrupting tendencies, right? And so he would actually, like a lot of atheists do, they would make the argument that the Christian society, at least the way that America had structured it, maybe not so much, you know, if you go back to the Holy Roman Empire or some of the other Christian governments throughout history, they would say the way that America established their Christian values and the way that we help uphold morality, or at least we did through our laws, that is much preferred to a lot of other religions and setting up a theocracy under their belief system. So Sam Harris can make some really good points, but of course here he makes quite the accusation, and if he does not repent before he is to stand before God, I would imagine that this is going to be something he is going to have to answer for, as will every other atheist who says such blaspheming things about God. But I think the issue and what's at the root always of his argument is that concept of good and bad. And again, this is all review, but this talks about the core of Harris's argument, or at least this part of it. It reverses the role of the creator and the created, and then gives the created the ability to judge the former, the creator. So what we believe, right, is that God is the essence of good. It is in his character, right? He cannot do anything that is wrong. And so he is the logos, he is the word, he is the standard of truth that we abide by, right? So we believe that God will then judge the actions of man based on his inherent nature and the impeccability of his judgment, He has to judge things that are in opposition to himself, right? Otherwise, he would not be inherently good. He couldn't allow that to continue, correct? But here we just kind of flip it around and we say, actually, our view of good and bad is, and Harris even says it himself, right? It's the human standards of morality. Right? So now, who determines human standards of morality? Sam Harris? Does he get to determine what morality is? Do theocracies like the one in Iran? Again, I'm using theocracy in a very general term, right? It's a religious-based government. Do they get to determine what morality is? So human-based morality, where does that come from? It's got to have an origin, right? And is it in philosophy? Is it just in how I feel, whether I feel mistreated or not, or whether I think someone else is being mistreated? Right? There's got to be something that you're founding that upon. You can't just say, this is good and this is bad. Where does that come from? So it ignores that foundational argument of morality. And I use this quote by Jordan Peterson, who I believe is either very close to becoming a Christian or may have already converted. It kind of depends on how recently you're listening to some of the things that he talks about. But he says, in a lecture, to make a rational argument, you have to have an initial proposition. So the initial proposition that Sam Harris is making is that the human standards of morality actually fly in the face of who God is, and therefore God is a contradiction of himself. And therefore, he uses that basis to say that he doesn't exist. Right? Because the ideas of those two things, they just don't jive. The proposition that underlies Western culture, and this is true, is that there is a transcendent morality, and this is the ethic that drives our culture. It's predicated on the idea of God. And you can't just take the idea of God away and expect our culture to remain intact midair without any foundational support. Okay, so you can kind of see where Sam Harris is, and he actually specifically talks about Sam Harris and the argument that he uses in one of the arguments he uses in this book, and says that's why I have an issue with what he's saying. And then he goes into this quote. Because you can't, as Sam Harris, you can't just say, I am judging God by this standard of morality and saying, because this is contradictory in my mind, therefore he doesn't exist, and I'm going to convince all of you of that. He's like, no, you can't just take away everything that undergirds your definition of morality, which is God, and then just expect that definition to stay intact. There's got to be something underneath it, right? And so for the past several hundred years, or even Western culture in general, it's been upheld by this idea of who God is and this transcendent view of good and bad. And now what atheism does is it just removes it and still expects everybody to abide by those morals. Does that make sense? Any questions about that? Yes.
I'm not necessarily about that. Who is Jordan Peterson?
Jordan Peterson is a psychologist. He gained fame, I believe it was the University of Toronto that he taught at, and he kind of came into the general public's view because he refused to use people's requested pronouns when referring to them, because he said it didn't make any sense for someone to tell him what to call them. If he believes that somebody is male by every definition of what a male is, and they say, no, you have to use the pronouns she and her, he said, you can't tell me that I have to say that. It's my freedom to use the pronouns that I want. And, of course, this blew up, primarily because it's Canada, but, subtle jab at the Canadians, right? That's where he, and then he began to, conservatives kind of latched on to him. Of course, he's a very highly intelligent person. Made arguments in favor of Western culture, and at least was initially coming from this point of view of, if you just look at all of the good things that have happened in Western culture, all the people that have been pulled out of poverty, just how our morality has led to a stable and successful culture, he's like, regardless of what you think about God, you can't argue against that. And so that, and because he is so highly intelligent, it just kind of carried him closer and closer and closer to this idea that, he himself would say, I can't disprove the Bible. It seems to be the most truthful document that has ever existed. And so he's reading this and he's giving lectures about the Bible as an unsaved person. And it seems that, like I said, he's either very close. And of course, the hangup is always Jesus, what you do with Jesus, right? Because he can say that, you know, I believe in God or I believe in the idea of God and that's all well and good. But what does he do with Jesus? And does he believe that he needs him for salvation? That I don't know. So we're going to talk about the Old Testament prophets, and the reason that I'm going to talk about the Old Testament prophets is because of that top bullet, because they were always talking about bad things happening. And who gave the prophets the words to say? Not a trick question. It's they all come from God. So God is telling these prophets, say a bunch of bad stuff that's going to happen to the children of Israel because I'm really upset with them over their lack of, for lack of a better word, for lack of morals, right? They were a very immoral people. And he uses some incredibly difficult to understand examples. Sometimes they're easy to understand in the sense that, you know, God always compares Israel to, you know, a sexually immoral woman, or he'll compare them to, you know, lost sheep, or he'll compare them to all sorts of things that really give us the image of how he feels betrayed by what his chosen people have done. But it also gives us this really important insight into what is actually good and what is actually bad and why, quote unquote, bad things happen. So why were these bad things happening with these Old Testament prophets? And I'm talking about the major and minor prophets. So you can go to Jeremiah. I'm going to talk about Hosea. I've actually been reading the minor prophets in my devotions, and so this kind of just all combined into, you know, what I'd been thinking about since I ended my unit on Islam. So there's two reasons. The first is judgment. Okay. The children of Israel were doing a bunch of bad stuff. They were doing the opposite of what God told them to do. And so therefore, bad things were happening because of judgment. Okay? The second thing is it was free will, right? The two words that are even more complicated than probably good and bad. It's free will. People are choosing to do the wrong thing. That is also why bad things are happening. Okay? And so I want to differentiate these two because you would say, well, people are choosing to do the wrong thing, and maybe that's successful for a while, but because it's the wrong thing according to God, they get judged, right? I'm not talking about that specifically. Okay, if somebody chooses to do the wrong thing, we know that based on life experiences, sometimes they will succeed. Maybe they'll succeed for a couple months, a couple years. Maybe they'll succeed for their whole life, and they'll get millions and billions of dollars, and then they die, and now they get judged. Okay. But right here in the Old Testament, bad things are happening because, specifically, God is judging their actions. Differentiate that with free will. I'm saying that bad things can happen to people just because somebody chooses to do a bad thing to them. Okay. So you might be an upright person. Like, look at the prophets themselves. Were they good, upright people? For the most part, they told the people exactly what God told them to tell them. And those messages were extremely difficult. And what did the people do to the prophets? Bad things, like kill them, right? Are those prophets being judged because by those bad things? No. It's just that the bad things are happening, okay? So those are two examples of bad things happening throughout these prophets, okay? God is judging people because of this, of their sin, and because they're just doing wrong, they're committing wrong actions against one another. So, this is the inevitable question. If God is in control and sin is wrong and it has to be punished with death, then why does God allow, in quotation marks, sin to take place? Okay. And this, again, goes back to what Sam Harris was talking about. God is, in his eyes, he's a contradiction because he can't be all holy and allow bad things to take place. So if he's completely in control and he's completely good, then he should always be in complete control of goodness, and there should be no bad that takes place, according to an atheist argument, right? From the first chapters of Genesis, it was very clear that choice was a key part in God's creation. Okay? So it's very important to go back to the structure, okay, and it's even the structure of our own minds and how we think as human beings. Okay? God did not create us to always do everything that he wanted us to do. Okay? And I'll talk about why that is in a little bit, but it's very important to identify that with the atheist, that people do have a choice. Okay? And it seems contradictory to us almost until you actually go into it with a little bit more of an open mind and say, okay, so God creates man with a choice. He can either choose wrong or he can choose right. So now, why does God allow the choice? What's the purpose for allowing that? Okay. So now let's go to Hosea. Chapter 1, and this is exactly what I was thinking of when I said there's a lot of things in the Minor Prophets that are difficult to understand when it comes to how God is picturing this judgment. Hosea is actually the first, at least in the biblical order, of the Minor Prophets. So I started here, and chapter 1, it just like nails you with something that you go, I have no idea what's going on here. Chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, in the beginning of the word of the Lord, by Hosea. And the Lord said to Hosea, go take unto thee a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms, for the land hath committed great whoredom, departing from God, from the Lord. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. What just happened? God just told his prophet to take a wife who was sexually immoral. How in the world, like God is, it seems as though God is commanding Hosea to do something wrong, correct? It's very difficult for us to completely picture. God gives the reasoning for it in these chapters, or in these verses. He says, because, I'm telling you to do this, because the land hath committed great whoredom departing from God. So in God's mind, he's saying, in this picture, for Hosea to understand what he is going through, God is going through. He wants to give him a life in which he has to experience a similar betrayal that God feels. Okay. But what does this have to do with choosing? Okay. Marriage is a very important picture throughout the Bible because God uses it so much when he talks about the immorality of his people in talking about a wife who is not faithful to her husband. Okay? And we have the picture of the church and Jesus as the bride and the bridegroom. Okay? So marriage is a very, very important picture to God and something he takes extremely seriously. Okay? Otherwise, he wouldn't use it so explicitly to show us the picture and how he feels when his people stray from him. Right? What is it about marriage that makes a marriage work so well? And there's exceptions to this. There are people who, have marriages in which they're set up. You know, maybe their parents choose a mate for them, and then they get saved, and then they remain married, and their relationship is very strong. But typically, it's because you choose that person to spend the rest of your life with, to enter a covenant with, that's what makes the marriage so strong. Okay? It's this picture of, I am choosing to be faithful to you. I don't have to be faithful to you. Okay? I could choose somebody else. Right? My wife could have chosen somebody else. We both went to a Christian college where there were a lot of people that we could have dated, people that we could have married. But what makes the relationship special is that knowing she could have chosen a lot of different people for her husband, she chose me. Okay. Would it have been wrong for her to choose someone else? It depends on how you view God's perfect will and his sovereign will and all of those things. But if you think about it, she probably could have ended up with somebody who was also, you know, very godly, maybe even somebody that went into the ministry. And they would have been happy and they would have remained faithful to each other and glorified God. But I know that she chose me. So now it makes it a whole lot more special than if she was forced to do that. Okay? So even from a human standard and our human nature, just think about it from God's point of view. Could he have created in his infinite power robots that always did the right thing? Always? Yes. But what creates that bond of a relationship between you and God? It's that you are choosing to do the right thing and that you could choose to do the wrong thing. That's what draws people so close together in their personal relationships and also draws you so close together with God. You have to choose to do that. Okay? And I think that that is the most practical example that we can find. And it's very practical here in the first chapter of Hosea. Like, listen, God chose the people of Israel. He didn't have to choose them. And he's trying to get that across to them. Didn't have to choose you. Didn't have to. But I did. And you chose to do the wrong thing. So let's go to the second chapter, verses 7 and 8. And when I read this in my devotions, it's very similar. If you think about it, again, think about it from God's point of view, it is very sad. Like, you can almost hear in the writing and in these words the sadness in his voice. And she is how verse 7 starts. He's talking about his people. And she shall follow after her lovers, but she shall not overtake them. And she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then she shall say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then it was it better with me than now. For she did not know that I gave her the corn and wine and oil and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. So here is this unfaithful woman who's chasing all of these other things and saying, now I found myself in all these terrible situations because of these choices, and I want to go back to the first husband. They want to go back to God. And God is saying, I gave you all of these things. I chose you. I chose you as a people to bless you. I gave you the corn and wine and oil and multiplied your wealth. What did you do with it? You took everything that I blessed you with and you gave it to another lover. You gave it to another husband. Okay? Imagine that from a marriage point of view, where a husband is lovingly doting on his wife and giving her gifts and just wants to bless her and wants to love her and have a relationship with her. He's choosing to be with her. And she's just like, I'm going to take all this stuff and I'm going to use it for my sinful lifestyle. Oh, the betrayal. As a husband, the betrayal that God must have felt. Okay? That's why this judgment is happening. That's why God is commanding Hosea to marry the person that he's marrying. Because Hosea knows personally, as a husband now, exactly how God feels. Okay? Choice of love, a choice to obey is of greater glory to God than forced obedience, and a choice of love is of greater value than forced affection. So, like I said, it's true even by our own human nature and our understanding of what love is. Choice is powerful. And that's why God created us with that choice. Let's go to the book of Amos. And Pastor was actually, I think it was it last Sunday afternoon that he gave a challenge from the book of Amos? And it might have even been this one of these passages. Amos 4 and verses 1 through 5. Hear this word, ye kine of Bashan, that are in the mountains of Samaria, which oppress the poor, which crush the needy, which say to their masters, bring and let us drink. The Lord God hath sworn by his holiness that, lo, the days shall come upon you that he will take you away with hooks and your posterity with fishhooks. And ye shall go out at the breaches, every cow at that which is before her, and ye shall cast them into the palace, saith the Lord. Come to Bethel and transgress. At Gilgal multiply transgression and bring your sacrifices every morning and your tithes after 3 years and offer a sacrifice of thanksgiving with leaven and proclaim and publish the free offerings, for this liketh you, O children, O ye children of Israel, saith the Lord. And what Pastor was saying is that, you know, there in verse 4, they're supposed to do all that stuff. right? They're supposed to bring their sacrifices every morning and their tithes after 3 years, and they're supposed to sacrifice with thanksgiving with leaven and proclaim and publish the free offerings, right? That's all talking about the laws that they're supposed to abide by. Why is it that he says then, come to Beth-El and transgress? Come do all that stuff and sin. And it's exactly, and I promise that Dave and I did not have this planned. It's exactly what he was talking about this morning. It's because in their spirit, they were doing all of the stuff even that we read in Hosea, where they were taking the bounty and the blessings of the Lord and even sometimes making sacrifices to him and doing that all while they were also worshiping all of these other idols and going after and practicing all of these other sinful cultures. Okay? Going through the motions of obedience results in judgment. So we know that God is not okay with us just being robots who just go through the motions of doing good, right? It's not the point. The point is that I want you to choose to do it. Okay? Jesus even says you have to worship God in spirit and in truth. You can't just worship him outwardly, and that's enough. And if God would have created us as robots who had no choice to do wrong, who had no choice to sin, then we would have been essentially just going through the motions because we could not have chosen to do the opposite. It's the choice. It's the inward choice and that spirit of wanting to do the right thing that God blesses. Much more so than the person who actually just outwardly does the right thing, but inwardly is not practicing that and is faithful to all, a bunch of other different ideas and philosophies, so to speak. So I'm going to end with this. I have a conclusion slide next, but I think that this is really at the core of an issue. So to kind of pull an example out of society, the proposition that God is to blame for sin and its effects. So I'm saying that Sam Harris is wrong when he talks about everybody that experiences bad things because he's blaming God or the idea of God for it, but it's like blaming guns for killing people. It's like blaming society for homelessness, blaming racism for single-parent homes, or babies for ruining irresponsible adults' lives. So you want to know how pervasive the idea of atheism is? It's all about irresponsibility. I don't have to answer for my actions. It's not my fault that bad things happen. I'm not the sinner. I'm not the person who has to choose to do the right thing. Okay? It's God. It's his fault. Right? And if you're an atheist and you don't believe in God, then you're just saying, well, that's just the way that things are. Okay? There's always something else to blame. Okay? So we don't have to just point the finger at God and say, it's all your fault that bad things happen. It's terrible when people do that. But the atheist doesn't believe in God in the first place, so he's not pointing his finger at God. He's pointing his finger everywhere else and saying, all this bad stuff happens because of all these other ideas. So if you want to know what the results of atheism are, it's irresponsibility. It's always somebody else's fault. It's not yours. The atheist takes zero ownership for their actions. Their actions are wired in them by biology. Okay? And they would even say, I don't really have a choice in what I do. Right? Because if it gets right down to evolutionary thought, it's all hardwired in you anyway, what you're going to do and say. As Christians, we say the killers are responsible for killing people. Okay? It's that pervasive saying, guns don't kill people, people kill people. Most often, addiction and bad choices lead to homelessness. You want to blame society for that? There's a lot of people in America that would blame all of us for the hobos that live in East Greeley. How was that my fault? I didn't choose to do drugs when I was 18. I didn't choose to do that. They chose that path. Okay? Now, are there actual homeless people who, through no fault of their own, find themselves in that situation? Probably not in the United States, to be blunt. Okay? There's a lot of things that people can do. There are a lot of helpful organizations and pathways for folks. Okay? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't feel sorry for people who are suffering from addiction. We should help them. But we should help them by pointing out that it's probably their own fault. And I say probably facetiously. It is. Single-parent homes result from shirking responsibility. I'm going to have an immoral relationship with somebody, she's going to get pregnant, and so I'm just not going to be around. That's too much responsibility. That's going to tie me down too much. That's the problem with single-parent homes. Sexual impropriety is to blame for unplanned pregnancies. You say, well, you pro-lifer. No, I'm pro-choice. Okay, I believe that you have a choice to have a relationship with somebody or not. And if you choose to have that relationship, that's the natural result. Okay, you're the person who is not pro-choice because you're not giving the life choice to live, right? How can you be pro-choice? There's no choice there. But it's not their fault. It's not their fault that they had an abortion. Yes, it was. Yes, it was. And what's the argument that's always made? Well, what about incest? Okay, so let's ban every abortion except for those specific circumstances. We will ban 99% of abortions. Look up the statistics. It's like 98 or 99%. It's not an argument. They're using the exception as the rule. Okay? It is sexual impropriety. That's why there's so many abortions. People do not want to live up. They don't want to fess up to their responsibility as making that choice. You did make the choice. You already made it. The choice has been made. Okay? Now you have to live with the result of that. I don't want to live with the result. So they get an abortion. So kind of off on a tangent a little bit there in society, but that is at the core of the argument for atheism. Okay? A lack of ownership. Okay? It's not my fault that sin happens. Okay? You can't blame me for that. That's just the way that things are. Okay? I'm hoping to actually continue this a little bit. I've talked to Pastor already about starting another Sunday school unit. It will probably have to wait until football season is over because that does absorb a lot of my time right now, but I really do enjoy ministering to those young men, and I hope that you would pray for me as I do that. I really do view it as a ministry. It's fun for me. It's something that I'm passionate about, but just being challenged over the last couple of years that I'm put there for a reason, and it's not because I love football. It's because I should love the Lord and witness to those young men, those coaches. So pray for me that my testimony remains strong and that I have opportunities to witness to players and coaches. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word and the